Good afternoon and welcome to State of the News on WFPL. I'm Gabe Bullard. With me in the studio right now are WFPL's Philip Bailey, Erica Peterson, and Devin Katayama. Thanks for being here.
Thanks.
What's going on, man?
And we want to hear from you. We want your comments. These topics come by fast, so if you want to join us on the air, call quickly. 502-814-8255 is the number. That's 502-814-TALK. You can also make comments on Twitter. We're at WFPL News, also on Facebook, or you can email to news@WFPL.org. Philip, I want to start with you and some news about State Senator Perry Clark.
Yes, State Senator Clark, he drafted a letter that was posted to a former presidential candidate, I guess you could say a perennial candidate, Lyndon LaRouche's website. On his site, State Senator Clark says, essentially, he compares President Obama to Adolf Hitler. He makes the statement that because of the legislation that created the super committee to deal with the debt ceiling, he finds that to be unconstitutional. He calls on President Barack Obama to resign, and if the president does not resign, he feels he should be impeached.
And so he's comparing this legislation that creates the super committee, he's comparing that with the legislation in 1930s Germany that had allowed Hitler to rise to power.
Yeah, and the letter, he says, it is, quote, a direct echo of the legislation that created or that paved the way for Hitler to take control of Germany. The reaction has been a bit of shock by Democrats who know State Senator Clark. State Representative Reginald Meeks, he said that he was shocked by the statements, that even though Senator Clark is a friend of his, he completely disagrees with the statements, and then it represents, once again, the party sort of turning its back on President Obama. Spokesman for Congressman Yarmouth, who did vote against the legislation, said that he disagrees with Senator Clark vehemently, and that he will work to reelect President Obama next year. One of the other things that was brought up or brought to our attention was that, you know, Senator Clark is a legislative chair in the Jefferson County Democratic Party. The state bylaws, the party bylaws, require those chairs to pledge their support for the nominee. Now, at this point, technically speaking, President Obama is not the official nominee for the Democratic Party next year. That won't happen until August after the convention. But many, including Clarence Yancey, who is a fellow legislative chair, brings up the point that if Senator Clark feels this way, he needs to step down from at least that position and maybe needs to switch parties. I asked him which party that Senator Clark should go to. Mr. Yancey said that Senator Clark may want to join Mr. LaRouche's party if he feels that way.
This is, in political discourse, sort of a nuclear option these days that it doesn't tend to garner a lot of respect or agreement in mainstream debate. Is there any evidence that this was coming? Could this have been predicted at all?
Well, those who I've spoken to say that, you know, Senator Clark is an independent thinker. State Representative Jim Wayne, for example, says that this is very uncharacteristic of Senator Clark. He didn't know that he felt this way about the president. Many, like you said, feel that comparisons between President Obama and Hitler are a bit beyond the pale. I think that that's generally how people feel. They're a bit taken aback by it. But many in party leadership don't know what to really do next. I mean, many haven't spoken to Senator Clark about this directly. I know Bill Ryan, the chairman of the Jefferson County Democratic Party, says that he wants to talk to Senator Clark about this, but it's not really clear what will happen to him. And many are saying, you know, it's free speech. He can say what he wants. But there's a question just of where this came from. I mean, demanding the president resign, then saying if he doesn't resign, he should be impeached, and then going further back saying that he essentially is behaving like Hitler with this creation of this super committee, which many do feel is constitutionally questionable. But many, you know, Representative Wayne, I think, pointed out he disagrees with the debt ceiling negotiations and what came out of it. Representative Yarmouth obviously voted against it. But comparing the president to Hitler, I think, for many was seen as extreme.
And this was done on state letterhead. Is there any ramification of that?
Representative Meeks indicated that there could be an ethics inquiry regarding that. There doesn't seem to be, however. Putting on a letterhead, he has that right as a state representative. That just seems to give it an official seal, but that doesn't really raise, I think, any direct ethical questions, although Representative Meeks did indicate that it might. But I think at this point, everyone is sort of just sitting back and going, is this another example? I think when we were at Fancy Farm this weekend, you notice the Republican candidates continually hammered President Obama. And you didn't hear one Democratic candidate come to the president's defense. Representative Meeks also pointed that out, saying that, you know, the party needs to step up and defend the president and the things that he's done, whether from natural disasters to health care, how this administration has put millions of federal dollars into the Commonwealth. Representative Meeks, who is a supporter of the president's, feel that the fellow Democrats haven't come to the president's support. And that's why you don't really hear many Democrats coming forward to denounce Senator Clark's statements.
And certainly an echo of a lot of things that, like you mentioned, happened at Fancy Farmer that are happening in these statewide races. And we'll touch on that a little bit later. In other political news, Republican gubernatorial candidate David Williams lost a campaign manager.
Yeah, Luke Marchant, who came from Florida, who was a former assistant to U.S. Senator Mark Rubio, a Tea Party favorite down there. He came on in May after Senator Williams had what many observers thought was a lackluster performance in the GOP primary. He did win that primary, obviously, but not by the margins that certainly people had expected the president of the state Senate to win. So there was a change, a shift around the campaign. They brought in Mr. Marchant, who many thought was going to be help Senator Williams out with Tea Party supporters, Tea Party voters in the state. And now he's leaving to pursue other professional endeavors. It's not really clear what that means. I spoke to Scott Jennings, who was the former campaign manager during the primary for Mr. Williams. He says that he won't be taking back over, but that he says there has been no announcement about a new campaign manager. He did indicate that, you know, Senator Williams is one of the most brilliant political minds in the state, which may indicate that Williams for right now is running his own campaign. So there's no official announcement on a replacement. Many are jumping on this, saying that, you know, after a new poll shows that, you know, Senator Williams is trailing Governor Beshear by 24 points, having your campaign manager quit not too long after that is another indication of a weakened campaign by Senator Williams. The campaign is trying to put its best face forward, saying that there's going to be a forum next week, continue to hit some of its talking points. But this certainly isn't good news for the Williams campaign.
And no word on what he's doing. Was there any idea that there may have been some disagreements, or is it completely friendly that he's taking off?
Well, rumors are abound. I mean, the rumors do indicate by some sources that there was some division as far as what direction the campaign should be going in. But I think overall the Williams campaign has made the point that it's still pretty early in the race. Senator Williams himself has said that not really until after Labor Day do people start paying attention to the governor's race here in Kentucky. What will be interesting to see is, coupled with not only Mr. Marchant's departure in the poll, but what the Republican Governors Association will do. They've put obviously some ads out attacking Governor Beshear in support of Mr. Williams. If they don't put out some new ads in the next couple of weeks and, you know, don't put any money into the race, that may indicate that Republicans nationally are backing away from Senator Williams' campaign, and he effectively will be on his own.
All right, and Devin, turning to you, there's been some controversy in Metro EMS lately involving patients' prescriptions or drugs and how they're handled. Tell us about that.
Yeah, they haven't been too lucky lately. In the past couple weeks, there were two EMS employees who were caught with medication that wasn't theirs. They're two separate instances, but the first one was an EMS employee who was driving an EMS vehicle and was found being a reckless driver and flipped his vehicle. He had around 180 vials of different medications that were supposed to be destroyed, and EMS protocols set up a pretty strict way to destroy medications. They have to sign off on a lot of paperwork, and it's pretty well regulated. This happened to be a case where he just went past the regulations and got caught. The second one was recently the same thing. An EMS employee got a DUI, and he was found having prescription medications on his person that weren't his. Dr. Neil Richmond, who's the executive director of Louisville Metro EMS, is going to start drug testing EMS employees within 45 to 60 days. That's something that he recently announced. He also told me earlier this week that he was planning on trying to partner up with the Louisville PD to strengthen the way that they, or the processes that they go through in order to destroy and handle medications.
And we do see the police department working every so often with the city on the drug tosses to dispose of a lot of these things for regular, for just citizens. And so
yeah,
now they may be helping with EMS.
Right, and
too.
They handle this regularly. They have a narcotics unit. So this is something that Louisville Metro EMS feels like PD knows a lot about and can possibly help him out.
And will the drug test become a regular thing, or is it this one time?
Right now, Dr. Neil Richmond said that they will do it again after this first 45 to 60 days. However, I don't see it really going past any more than twice. Normally, in EMS systems, you are subject to random drug samplings. which is just the normal way it goes. But for these specific instances, I think Dr. Richmond wants to set an example and show that they are strict in taking these issues seriously.
And we'll definitely be following that in the weeks to come. Another thing you covered this week, Devin, and have been following for a while, the Merger 2.0 Task Force, they had a survey and they asked citizens various questions. That came out this week, and you were watching those results.
This survey was really interesting. It said a lot about the city, but we also want to be careful when we look at this. This is part of the Merger 2.0 Task Force, like you were saying, and they conducted the survey in July for 1 week, and they are all phone interviews, and they had over 1,000 phone interviews in this specific sample. And it said a lot of interesting things. Specifically, the most important thing, or maybe not the most important thing, but the biggest takeaway that I saw was that people were less satisfied with the transportation in the metro area than any of the other services. The other services were rated relatively decently, 75% satisfaction or 70% satisfaction rate and above for most of the services. And for transportation, it was only around 50%.
And what was it like? Who was responding how to that? Because this was broken down into demographics, right? Who
responded? Yeah, they say it was a random sample. But when you look at some of the numbers, and maybe Philip can weigh in on this, we see that some areas have higher number of interviews than others.
Yeah, one thing you notice, I think when you look at the crosstabs in particular, is that the raw numbers may not necessarily reflect what the percentages say. In some of these surveys, for example, when you look at categories by race, when you talk about people who feel safe in their own neighborhoods, some of the surveys indicate that, you know, about 837 whites were interviewed, while only about 150 African Americans were. Well, what I thought was really interesting was the breakdowns, not in just in regards to race, but in regards to zip codes. For example, people were asked how safe they feel in their own neighborhood. In the 40212 zip code, which is the Shawnee, Portland neighborhood mainly, covers that area, 27.2% feel less safe. That's meaning they answered either one, absolutely disagree with that statement, or two, somewhat disagree with that statement. If you look at the 40203 zip code, which covers Russell, Limerick, Smoketown, which I believe is like one of the poorest zip codes in the city and maybe even in the country, mm-hmm. I think I saw a survey say, 33% feel less safe compared to only 35% who feel safe. Now, some of this has to do with income. If you look at a zip code like 40207, which is Indian Hills, Riverwood, parts of St. Matthews, 88% of people feel that they and their family are safe in the neighborhood. When you look at those demographics, generally speaking, African Americans feel safer in their neighborhoods than they don't feel safe. But when compared to whites, they feel less safe. Once you go down for income for those who make $20,000 or less, all the way up to people who make over $100,000, the higher up on income you go, the more safe people feel. Some of that, I think, is just, you know, the natural stratification of any city. But like Devin said, the what's really interesting is that the survey went even further, maybe did more sampling of those groups. When you talk about maybe including more African Americans, more lower income folks, what I also found rather interesting was when the question was asked, would you be willing to pay more for certain city services? Those who made over $100,000, 60% said yes, they are willing to pay more for certain city services. So, you know, overall, when people say taxes remains like the third rail of politics, for that demographic group, people who make over $100,000 in the city, they say, at least in the survey, they're willing to pay more.
And something I just want to say really quickly is, when looking at some of these numbers, and I think you mentioned this happened in the area that you were looking at as well, but once you get to a certain income group, I think it was 80,000 to 99,000, something like that, the numbers dip. So you do see these trends, and then all of a sudden you get to that specific income level and you see a slight dip, and then after that it goes back up, depending on what you're looking at.
And that's because of the raw numbers. What Devin's talking about when it comes to asking people how safe they feel in their communities, when you go down the line on income levels, about every group is about 100, 120 represented. But that $80,000 to $99,000 group, only 44 were actually surveyed. So part of it is, with any, you know, any sociologist or people who do with data and take surveys will tell you, your survey is just as good as, you know, there's flaws in it.
Right.
But the sampling group does affect the outcome.
And how complete of a picture do you think this is, given that sampling group? What can we infer safely to say this is how this group of people might feel, or this people living in this area or people of this income group, compared to what actually might be due to some demographics perhaps not being represented?
I think what I pulled from it was that people who are of lower income and African Americans, generally amongst themselves feel safe overall. More than 50%, 60%, 70% in some areas feel safe in their neighborhoods, like the city services they're getting, are satisfied with, for example, with EMS, fire, and police service. But when compared to more affluent folks and compared to their white counterparts, those groups feel less safe or less satisfied with the services. So the stratification really is that people who generally are more optimistic and feel better about the city are more affluent whites compared to probably less affluent people and less affluent African Americans.
And also, when thinking about what the point of this survey was and what the whole point of the Merger 2.0 Task Force is to study the level of service they're receiving from county government, from metro government, and thinking about how Mayor Fisher will be looking at this survey and looking at these subcommittee recommendations, I think it's important to kind of take everything with a grain of salt and look at where major things are happening. For example, the transportation, where 50%, it was obvious. I mean, the mayor's office even stated they're less satisfied with that. Usually, they don't necessarily like to just come out and say people are less satisfied with certain services. So I think the mayor will definitely be taking a look at that. I spoke with the executive director of TARC, Barry Barker, and he said that he constantly has communication with Mayor Fisher, and he expects Mayor Fisher to take this very seriously and to look at some of the issues that might be concerning transportation.
But one more point, I guess, on the transportation part, though, that's interesting, is that those who actually use TARC are more satisfied with the service and what basic services they already have to be improved slightly. But those who don't use TARC at all, they have this sort of view that TARC is completely inadequate and they want to expand it to light rail or some completely different public transportation service. I talked to Shakita Tinsley, a small business owner in Shively, and she was saying that she thinks that this needs to expand and that they need to do a survey for more groups to learn more about what citizens actually think.
And we're starting to see in that, at least, it seems that it illustrates some of the stigma of riding a bus, that a lot of people tend to not use public transportation. And, you know, we hear it out when we're interviewing people on public transit stories. A lot of people don't ride the bus for various reasons, but there is sort of a stigma, it seems, for people who don't use public transit against using a bus that they might not have for light rail, for something like that. And so that's just interesting to see that. We also got a comment from Twitter here asking, I'm not sure if this was recorded, in the survey results, did people without internet access participate in this? Were they able to take part of the survey?
This survey was actually all phone interviews, which took place for a week in July. Actually, Philip and I were just talking about this upstairs. We thought, we were considering whether or not they had the opportunity to maybe do a ballot survey or a mailing survey, which would, reach more people. But this one was specifically just over 1,000 people that were interviewed on the phone.
And I'm not sure if that phone survey, once again, when you get into those surveys, does that include just landlines? Does that include cell phones? It's obvious that younger people, what I mean by that, 35 and under, generally have cell phones. Many people who are in that age demographic don't even have a landline anymore. So those questions, I think, would be important for how the survey should be looked at.
And one more quick thing that I found really interesting. 8% of the people that were surveyed did not know that there was a merger.
Right. This is a survey that's supposed to measure satisfaction with merger, but people didn't know there was a merger.
Right. And there's a lot of people in between who were kind of confused about what exactly merged, who was paying taxes in certain areas. So we did see some kind of confusion within the survey results as well.
Yeah, I think it was 66% did know that merger did not include all of the fire and all of the smaller cities. So that, and I think another 60% said that they did know that there were different tax structures, tax payments, depending on where you live. So it makes it clear that people, while they know that merger did occur, there still is a great percentage of people in Louisville who don't know the details that, there are certain services that aren't combined and certain tax systems that aren't combined as well.
And there are a lot of oddities and intricacies in this merger that we're going to be looking at even more, involving the small cities and the tax rates and all that. So that's something we'll be following on WFPL, and you can find a link to this survey on our website, wfpl.org. Is it search on survey results? Or
Merger 2.0 survey.
All right.
2.0 is 2.0, in case you're wondering.
Yeah, and we'll toss a link up on the Facebook, too, whenever we can. As soon as we can, we'll put a link up to that story. Erica, I want to turn to you now. There's a discussion of utility rates in the Metro Council this week.
There is, and it's really it's nothing new or groundbreaking for people who have been following this discussion, because on June 1st, LG&E did file with the Public Service Commission, basically asking for a 19% rate increase by 2016 to recoup their costs from complying with a bunch of environmental regulations. And as you know, as we've been looking at, you know, various points over the past few months, the EPA has already unveiled several air regulations designed to reduce the number of pollutants in the air, and there are a couple more that are expected to come down the pike. So the 19% increase is going to cover the costs of LG&E upgrading several of its newer coal-fired power plants.
And is there a thought then that these new regulations would require further upgrades, further costs, further rate increases?
Well, these new upgrades, the regulations will require the upgrades that they're planning on right now. And they have some room built into that because not all the regulations are finalized. But they have a pretty good idea of what they're going to have to comply with. But there's some older coal-fired power plants, most notably Cane Run here in Louisville, where they're doing, they've done cost analyses on them, and they don't really think it's going to be worth it to put all this money to upgrade the systems because they're so old, it's going to cost a lot of money. So they're basically looking at other options. And yet they testified, some company representatives testified before the Metro Council Energy and Environment Committee yesterday. And they basically said they can try to buy the power that they would need to replace these plants from other companies. They can try to buy existing plants from other companies to put on their grid, or they can build a whole new plant themselves. And yeah.
Is LG&E ever caught off guard by the environmental regulations, or is this something that they know is coming, they know perhaps they should prepare for if a plant is aging? What's the situation there?
Well, they really do know what's coming, pretty much, because when rules come out, the EPA issues a proposed rule, there's a comment period, there's this whole rulemaking process. So when the proposed rule comes out, it might change a little bit, but generally companies have a good idea. And they don't have to comply with a rule right away. When the rule comes out, it doesn't say like, bam, you know, comply with this right now. It's a, you know, a year down the line, 2 years, sometimes 4 years down the line. So there are benchmarks that the company will have to meet along the way.
And what was the reaction from the council members in this discussion?
Well, it was a pretty small committee. There were about four council members there. And they had some questions about ways that their constituents could reduce energy. One councilman in particular, Councilman Brent Ackerson, was asking whether the company had to take Kentucky's future into consideration. And he didn't come right out and say it, but I kind of inferred that he was talking about, you know, could they stay with coal even if it was going to be more expensive than, say, natural gas down the line, just because of the role coal plays in Kentucky's economy? And LG&E, John Voiles, one of their vice presidents, basically said it's up to the PSC. The LG&E has to provide the electricity cheaply, and they have to provide enough of it to power what we need. That's their mandate. And if coal is going to be more expensive, then they're going to have to switch to something else.
And this all comes as LG&E is facing a fine from the Air Pollution Control District here in Louisville.
Yeah, they've been fined once. And I talked to Lauren Anderson of the Air Pollution Control District earlier this week, and she said they were getting ready to issue another notice of violations to the company, because there's been coal ash documented coming off of their landfill and leaving the property and going onto people's houses.
And last week, there's environment news that isn't LG&E related, that isn't necessarily coal related, surprisingly. And so last week, you talked about this chemical leak in the Rubbertown neighborhood, another chemical leak in the Rubbertown neighborhood. But there's been some action on that and some changes happening.
Yeah, and the company spokesman I spoke to this morning will stress that this news is not related to the leaks. It wasn't done because of the leaks. But basically, the chemical that leaked was a chemical called toluene, and it's used in making rubber, and it's a hazardous chemical. And it leaked twice, two fairly minor leaks, but still leaks just the same in 2 weeks. And now we learn that the company, American Synthetic Rubbers, has applied for a Title V permit from the Air Pollution Control District to start construction to basically move their plant away from using this chemical. And what they're going to replace it with is two other chemicals called cyclohexane and methyl cyclohexane. And the company is, you know, is kind of pushing this up and saying, well, you know, these are non-hazardous chemicals. They aren't on the same pollution list, basically, that toluene is. Some people in the Rubbertown neighborhood are still a little bit skeptical about it, though.
How long will this take?
Could be a couple of years. Basically, this is not a done deal. They're starting the ball rolling. Assuming they get this permit granted, they'll start the process and still have to evaluate if it's, I think, the final way they're going to go.
All right. And we'll be hearing more about that in the future. Something else that came to our attention this week, it was CN2's Pure Politics talked about this. Philip, you brought this to our attention as well, and I'd done some research on this, and we had the story yesterday. WHAS Radio is using new promos to promote their news and talk content. Let's hear one of those.
Woo! Man, it's hot.
Man, you're telling me, Obama.
Not everyone has a pool.
Hey, can we get a couple iced teas with those cute umbrellas?
Couple burgers, too.
Yes, sir.
Or a full-service bar.
Oh, yeah.
But this summer, you do have a radio with top-shelf information and tasty talk you can sink your teeth into.
Hey, darling, a little more sunscreen?
Nothing we can do about the sunscreen.
Oh, that's okay. We'll just add it to the budget.
Bill, what are you doing?
Uh-oh.
84 WHAS.
To clarify, in case you couldn't tell, that's not the real president.
It's not President Obama or former President Clinton.
Yeah, they didn't come to Louisville to record those in the studios at HAS. Those are locally produced ads, but those are something that they're promos. There are three of them. They're on our website on WFPL.org if you go and search for them. It's interesting, Philip, we were talking about this, that these ads present WHAS, perhaps what listeners already know, is presenting some information that the president wouldn't necessarily find exactly helpful.
Yeah, the impersonators and lampooning the president has been a history in this country since its inception. I mean, that's just a part of what we do here in America. What's interesting, though, is that the impersonations do, from a news content standpoint, point out that the president wouldn't like the content that he would hear necessarily on 84 WHS. Everyone knows, general observers, political observers understand that if you turn on WHAS in the morning, its commentary is more conservative. Rush Limbaugh is the king of right-wing talk radio, mm-hmm. is on their programming. Mandy Connell, who certainly I think has shown to have a conservative bit in some of her commentary. So overall, that's not surprising. What is that this is a promotion of the news content, of saying that it would, you know, having the last two Democratic presidents, totally skipping over, mind you, the 8 years of President George W. Bush, who I think many people could criticize from a right or left standpoint, honestly. So this isn't that surprising to people. It's just surprising in the sense that it's from the news content perspective. I mean, from the commentary viewpoint, I think it's pretty clear that if you turn on HAS, you're not going to hear someone who's very favorable of President Obama, whether Rush Limbaugh or Ms. Connell, who last year did apologize, but she did refer to the president as a half-breed man for his interracial background. So this is not that surprising for I think, general observers, but for those of us in the media, promoting the news from a certain political standpoint is.
And we called over to Kelly Carls. He's the director of operations for WHAS. He declined to comment. He did tell CN2 that the ads are just meant to be funny. There is this long history of political commentary. No explanation for why there weren't also parodies of George W. Bush, but he said essentially that it's some harmless fun that they're having to entice the listeners to stay tuned to that. Moving on, something that you had covered, Philip, in the Metro Council, the Life Jacket Ordinance.
Yes, the Life Jacket Ordinance, as it's being called, was introduced by Councilman Vicki Aubrey-Welch of the 13th District. It's been co-sponsored by Marianne Butler. The bill essentially is in response to what has been a series of drowning deaths and accidents involving young children. The legislation would require parents, guardians to put a life jacket on anyone 12 years or younger in a public waterway, meaning a creek, a stream, a river. It would require that, and it would levy a $100 fine if that wasn't if a child under that age, 12 or younger, wasn't wearing a life preserver flotation device of some sort. Meaning the Coast Guard has three different levels of different types of life preservers that it identifies. The legislation was encouraged by a police lieutenant in the Metro Police Department who contacted Councilwoman Welch, and she's been talking with them for a number of weeks. And she feels this, you know, legislation is really just to help and save lives, really, essentially. The exemption would be the public pools, because you would have a lifeguard from the city working there, but for everywhere else. The question that critics have raised isn't that they're against the law itself, but there are just some remaining questions. For example, if you were to bring your child to Waterfront Park, how close do you have to be to the Ohio River to where this law would apply to you? Is it 15 feet, 10 feet at the water's edge? Also, there's some questions about cost, you know, for lower income folks, requiring them to purchase a life preserver. Councilman Welch has responded to that by saying that, you know, a child's life is priceless. So the jockeying over this issue really comes down to the details. Councilman Welch has said that she just wants, even if the legislation doesn't pass, she feels that this debate is necessary, and that, you know, some of this is preventable, but that parents aren't necessarily taking their full responsibility and precautions. But if you look at some of these recent deaths and drownings of young people in the community, the law wouldn't have necessarily saved them. Some of these drownings happened at private country clubs, at hotels. They didn't happen at public waterways. I think there was at least one where a six-year-old girl did tragically drown in the Ohio River, whether that was in lower southwest Jefferson County and parts of Hardin County. But still, the legislation has been read into the council at its full meeting yesterday, and it will go to the Public Safety Committee, where it will be debated and come out of committee, or may or may not come out of committee, depending on if these questions can be answered.
There's bound to be some interesting debate around that, and that's something that we'll be following as it happens. And Devin, we'll go back to you. You've been following the Clark County budget situation pretty closely, and what's the latest on that?
Well, today was the day that all the department heads were supposed to have their response to how they're going to stay within their budget. I spoke with Council President Kevin Vissing today, and he said that it's not every department that's kind of crunched or that kind of needs to respond as quickly as others. And he mentioned that next week they'll still be accepting responses. But he did mention the sheriff's office, which did come out earlier this week, and say that they will be making some little cuts, and that cut was restricting the sheriff office people to only use their vehicle for company purposes. They can take their vehicle home because they don't have enough room in their parking lot, but that only restricts them from using it, from taking it home, back to work to home. I'm not quite sure exactly what they were doing before, but also the commissioner's office will also be asked to respond how it's going to reduce its budget. I haven't heard back yet exactly what their response was. I do will be speaking with Kevin later this afternoon to find out exactly what they were going to be doing.
All right, we'll keep an eye out for that and end on a more fun note here, the Little League World Championship. We have a local tie to that.
Yeah, the North Oldham County will be playing in the regional finals this Saturday against Hamilton, Ohio. And this is kind of exciting for the area. The last team to win the Little League World Series was Louisville's Valley Sports American Little League in 2002. So this is exciting for them. Right now they're up in Indianapolis, and they are at the Central Region Little League headquarters. They're playing the game Saturday. In the past week, they've just been hanging out in the hotel. It's where all the teams stay, so they've been meeting new people from all over, making friends, and it also takes some of the pressure off the kids. The ESPN crews are going to be out there this weekend to start actually showing the games. And then if they win, whatever team wins, they go to Williamsport, Pennsylvania, and that's where they play the Little League World Series. They'll have to win in an 8-team tournament to be the top USA seed, and then they'll play whatever international team wins their 8-team tournament, and then that will be the champion of the Little League World Series.
And this is broadcast on, like you said, ESPN.
It'll be on ESPN. Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you very much. That's all the time we have for this segment. I'd like to thank Devin Katayama, Erica Peterson, Philip Bailey from the WFPL Newsroom. Thanks for being here, guys.
Thanks.
All right. When we come back, we'll talk with Jim Carroll from the Courier-Journal about events in Washington. After that musical interlude, welcome back to State of the News on WFPL. I'm Gabe Bullard. We're going to be talking about the Congressional Super Committee this segment with the Courier-Journal's Jim Carroll. Give us a call at 502-814-8255 if you'd like to join us. You can also send a message on Twitter. We're at WFPL News. We're also on Facebook, and you can email news@WFPL.org. Jim, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me again. Glad to be here.
All right. And first, let's just start with a little explanation of the super committee and what they've been tasked with.
Well, people are going to hear a lot more about it in the coming weeks and months, so fair warning. This was a special panel created under the debt deal that was just worked out between the White House and Congress after much Sturm und Drang, as we recall. This was one of the provisions of the deal, which was to create this special 12-member committee, six Republicans, six Democrats. It'll have six senators and six House members to basically come up with additional reductions in the deficit, basically at least $1.2 trillion over the next 10 years. They're looking more like $1.5 trillion, and of course they can do even better, all the much better for that. But that's their essential mission, and all the members have now been appointed. So the 12 members have been appointed, and they're calling it a super committee because pretty much its jurisdiction, it's called the Joint Select Committee on Deficit Reduction. And so it's basically covering any function of the government. So it's going to have a lot of it's going to be able to look anywhere they want to look for possible spending cuts and revenue raisers if that becomes an agreed upon part of the agenda. You know, you're talking everything from defense to health care and, of course, what happens in the long-term entitlement programs like Social Security and Medicare. So it's a very wide-ranging, and that's why they're calling it a super committee.
And Senator Mitch McConnell of Kentucky, as Senate Minority Leader, got to make some appointments to this committee. What do those choices for his appointments say about him, about what he might be expecting from this?
Well, that's right. He appointed people that are, you know, he appointed John Kyle from Arizona, who is his basically his lieutenant in the Senate leadership. So, you know, I think it's clear whatever Kyle discusses and you know, agrees to would certainly require he couldn't do it. Basically, he's not going to wander off the farm too far with you know, with McConnell, because he and McConnell are very close. He also appointed Rob Portman, senator from Ohio, who is a former budget director under George W. Bush, and then Pat Toomey, who's really the, you might say, the Tea Party flag on the committee. He's a senator, freshman senator from Pennsylvania, and so that's certainly a nod to the Tea Party element. So obviously the leadership is going to have, they pick these people. Each leader in the House and the Senate pick three. So these people are obviously beholden to the leader and vice versa. There's not going to be anything discussed in the committee the leaders aren't going to know about, and presumably that the leaders wouldn't sign off on. So there'll probably be a lot of extra conversation going on outside the committee besides what goes on inside the committee.
And so these appointments, is it shaping up to be more of what we have seen with some of the debt ceiling negotiations, or does it look like, given this group, there may be a little bit more room for compromise, a little bit more openness to compromise? And certainly the different timeline would have something to do with that, too.
Yeah, you know, the city is divided on this. You know, in some ways, you could, at its most elemental level, you could say that the creation of the super committee is an admission of failure because the full Congress couldn't, in its wisdom, 535 members couldn't come up with a better deal other than to appoint a committee to find further cuts down the road. You could look at it that way. But the other thing is, this is a short timeline, as you just referred to. They have to make recommendations. They have to basically come up with a list of what they want to do by Thanksgiving. Has to be voted on by both houses before Christmas, and then a final deal has to be enacted by, I think it's around January 15th. And so that's a short timeline to come up with something. And the other part of this equation, which people haven't focused enough on yet, but more will be said about it later, is if they are unable to agree, and a lot of people see this committee as Congress in microcosm, you know, it's just going to be more fights, but with 12 people instead of everybody. if they fail to agree, automatic cuts will kick in the middle of January. And those are across-the-board cuts in everything from defense and health care and everything. So there is an incentive on both sides to basically control the budget-cutting mayhem, if you will, by directing where these cuts should happen, because failure means these cuts will be automatic everywhere, and there'll be blood on the floor from favorite programs on both sides of the aisle. So that's the one incentive and perhaps motivation for people to try to come to some agreement. I would also add that, you know, just since this committee was created, we've had a bit of looks like Six Flags on the stock market. You know, people have been going up and down every day with, you know, these wild swings in the market. Certainly a indicator that people are feeling very uneasy about where things are in the economy. And that may be some additional motivation, too, that, you know, wasn't even there when a few weeks ago before, Standard & Poor's did their number on the U.S. debt rating.
And that we might see the committee reacting a bit to the markets, or even vice versa.
Well, I think the committee, you know, they're paying attention here. They understand, you know, what's going on out there. I think, though, the committee, this sort of adds another layer because people's eyes have sort of been open to the fact that the economy, people thought, you know, we're puttering along, we're muddling through, we got a deal, and then Standard & Poor's, you know, dropped the debt rating. And people were concerned about that, but the market seemed to be wildly concerned about it. And it sort of, I think, shook a lot of people. People realized, you know, could we really be going all the way back to 2008 or before? Or even, you know, are we looking at a double-dip recession? All kinds of things like that. So I think, you know, the political atmosphere, while a lot of the same issues apply and people are going to argue over, you know, should we have more taxes? You know, do we need to change the taxes? Do we raise taxes on some people and not others? Do, you know, close loopholes? What kind of spending do we need to cut? All that kind of stuff, that's all still there. But it's now against this new backdrop of perhaps a much more volatile stock market and other indicators that if Congress fails to do something, could, you know, it could just go wild again. And I think people would, I think there's an instinct in both political parties, if you inject too much uncertainty, you never know where the bodies are going to fall, you know, as a result of that. So I think people would like to calm the markets and calm public fears and try to inject a little more certainty, if that is possible, into the economy and into the future of the economy. And I think, failing to come to an agreement on what happens next would just throw that all out the window, and I don't think people really want to risk that.
And we have about a minute left in this segment. Very quickly, looking outside the committee to Kentucky's other senator, Rand Paul, the junior senator. We see him on TV a lot. We see him cited as a leader in this Tea Party wing, and we saw at Fancy Farm some friendly words exchanged between him and Senator McConnell, despite some disagreements on these debt deals. Does Senator Paul have much sway in the larger operations of the Senate at this point?
Well, he does, and, you know, the rules in the Senate are different from the rules in the House, and one senator can hold things up. It sounds like a negative thing, but, you know, if you have a concern, if you're trying to stop a nomination or you want to hold up a nomination for a while or a bill or something, a senator can do that, unlike a House member, because of the unique way that Senate rules are structured. And in that way, he has had some impact because he has done this. You know, he raised concerns about extending the term of the director of the FBI and partly over just the constitutional concerns about adding two more years to his 10-year term. And also he had some concerns about how the FBI was handling cases like the two terrorists who were apprehended in Kentucky. Anyway, he had Rand Paul had a meeting with the Director Mueller, and they had a pleasant conversation, apparently, next thing we know, Senator Paul has removed his objection to at least having a vote on extending the term, and Mueller's term was extended. But he can have that kind of influence, and because he is a voice of the Tea Party, which is a prominent center of political power in Washington right now, you know, he certainly serves that role too as a spokesman for that movement.
All right, and that's all the time we have for this segment. Jim Carroll with the Courier-Journal, thanks for joining us. Thanks for sharing your insights.
Have a great weekend.
All right, you too. And when we come back on State of the News on WFPL, we'll hear we'll talk with reporter Eric Durbin about cattle auctioneering. That's just ahead and on State of the News. And welcome back to State of the News on WFPL. I'm Gabe Bullard. What does it take to be a world champion auctioneer? In a livestock arena, it helps to be knowledgeable, fast, and friendly. At least that's what Harvest Public Media's Eric Durbin found out as he caught up with the newest champ and his world.
All right, checking the high up, a little bit down, 675, a little bit down, 700, not a little bit down, 675, a little bit down, 700, not a little bit down, 777, 675, a little bit down.
Fast talking comes in handy at a livestock auction. You just heard two of the fastest, world champion auctioneers from Kansas. Now, there's a third from the Sunflower State.
I'm Charlie Cummings, and I'm from Yates Center, Kansas. And I've just recently won the World Livestock Auctioneer Championship.
And that has turned Cummings into somewhat of a celebrity in livestock circles. Recently, he was welcomed to the microphone in Holton, Kansas.
Your normal auctioneer, Danny, was not able to be here tonight, and I had called Charlie, and then I tell you what, his price went up. He went ahead and fooled around and won the championship, and I tell you what, I want to congratulate Charlie. Thank him for coming. Give him a warm welcome.
And the fun begins.
Boys, I need some choice cattle now. Roger. 140.
Maybe you didn't quite catch that.
Yeah, it was what I use in my chant a lot is one, make it one, bid it on, now two. And when you speed it up, it goes one, make one, bid it on, now two, and two, make it two, bid it on, bid it on, three. And just kind of rolls from there.
He sips lemon water and avoids tobacco to keep his voice strong. But there's more to his title than just a quick tongue.
A good auctioneer at a livestock market is one that knows what it is to represent the cattle because you're representing one man's livelihood. He needs to know the market from week to week and needs to know what the cattle are worth.
There are roughly 900 livestock auction houses nationwide. These aren't your artsy paddle-waving affairs, though. Buying and selling cattle is the driving force of the event. But it's also a chance to chat up your neighbor and swap stories. On this hot, sticky night at the Holton Livestock Exchange, the ceiling fans are working overtime to keep the air moving amongst the dozens of people on hand. Dressed up in khaki pants, white button-down shirt, tie, cowboy hat, and champion belt buckle, Cummings talks fast to a jeans-wearing group who bid with barely a tip of the hand. The action moves quick as spotters yell out bids.
Yeah, when I first started out, I can remember one guy, he said, "Now every time I shake my cigarette, I'm bidding." So,
Cummings sits perched in front of a small corral where more than 1,300 cattle will be sold over the course of the evening. He says he once sat down to a livestock auction at 9:30 p.m. and didn't get off the microphone until 1:45 a.m. Auctioneering was introduced to Cummings at an early age by his uncle, and he's worked to hone his craft ever since, even attending the Worldwide College of Auctioneering in Mason City, Iowa. This was his fourth time competing in the Livestock Marketing Association's annual championship.
Now that it's kind of soaked in for me a little bit, you know, the easiest way for me to describe it is it's like a lifetime goal and an honor, and now it's going to be important that I carry it out and live it.
For the next year, Cummings will travel around the country visiting sale barns and promoting the auction method of selling.
I like to think my style is one that anybody can relate to. My uncle always taught me at a young age, if they don't know where you're at and don't know what you're asking for, then they're not going to be it.
As he traverses the country in his new championship-issued pickup truck, Cummings hopes his style of auctioneering shines through. Eric Durbin, Harvest Public Media.
And with us now on State of the News via phone is Eric Durbin. Hi, Eric.
Hi, how are you doing?
Pretty good. So we're a little short on time here, so I'm going to have to ask you to be quick. I apologize for that. But how did you come about finding this story, and how does one become the world champion auctioneer? How is that? How is the work separated from the rankings?
Sure. Well, Charlie Cummings, I cover Kansas agriculture for Harvest Public Media and Kansas Public Radio, and Charlie is from Kansas, and so after... It kind of came to our attention after he won the championship, and his first appearance happened to be in Holton, Kansas. And so it was an opportunity to not only go and meet him, but also get to check out you know, kind of his work and the auction, livestock auction event.
And go ahead.
Yeah, and he's actually the one of the interesting things I thought was interesting about it is not only are you judged on whether or not you can actually sell cattle, but it's also about whether or not you can be a good representative for the industry. And so that was a big part of, it's actually an event, these championships. So it's whittled down to 12 contestants at the end, and then they all call an auction and sell cattle, and they're judged on their abilities, but then they're also judged through an interview process on whether or not they can represent the industry well.
All right, and I tell you what, I'm sorry, we're just running out of time right now. You can find this story, you can find more information on WFPL.org. We're State of the News, and this is all the time that we have. So I want to thank our guests, Eric Durbin, thanks for being here. Also thanks to Jim Carroll of the Courier-Journal, and from our own newsroom, Philip Bailey, Devin Katayama, and Erica Peterson. State of the News is produced by the WFPL Newsroom. Our production team is led by Laura Ellis and Brad Yost. For more information and for full audio of this program, go to WFPL.org. Thanks for listening to State of the News. I'm Gabe Bullard.
Get along, little doggy, better be on your way.